Hey, and welcome to this week's podcast. I've always been a fan of the band, not sort of a deep, obsessive fan. You know, it's one of those things like my parents didn't have albums by the band, my older brother didn't, and I heard some of the hits on the radio, but it took me a while to sort of figure out what they were about and, you know, realize how deep all the albums were. So, and such a band, so much baggage. Every guy in that band has a story. Such a bunch of oddballs and so much drugs and, you know, especially after they broke up, just a lot of dysfunction. So I was very interested when I heard about this book, Richard Manuel, His Life in Music, From the Hawks and Bob Dylan to the Band, written by Stephen T. Lewis. His website is talkfromtherockroom.com. And it's just a book written with a lot of love, and it's so deep, and it's a 400-page book. And so I was struggling a little bit with how do I touch on enough interesting things but not give away the whole plot of the book, etc. So I hope I've done that. Definitely a very sincere and committed writer here. So I think you'll find this interesting. It's such an interesting story, and there's such great music attached to the life of Richard Manuel. So here it is. This is me and Stephen T. Lewis, author of Richard Manuel, His Life in Music, From the Hawks and Bob Dylan to the Band. Comes out June 17th. Again, his website, talkfromtherockroom.com. There is the voice of Richard Manuel, and Stephen Lewis joins us. He is the author of the first official biography of Richard, called Richard Manuel, His Life and Music, From the Hawks and Bob Dylan to the Band. It comes out June 17th. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So this is such an interesting story. I just finished reading the book. It's a nonstop ride, especially because he got started so young, you know, and sometimes it's a ride up with him and sometimes it's a ride down. And I think you do a careful job sort of balancing the evidence of his huge talent and his huge troubles. And it seems like maybe that was one of your goals in writing this, was to sort of reset his legacy and start a conversation around him and his musical contributions. Is that correct?
That's exactly what I wanted to do. I felt like that Richard had kind of been defined by the troubles that you just spoke of, not by any fault of his own, but I just feel like because he didn't do a lot of interviews in the time that he was around, and because, you know, The Last Waltz is one of the most legendary musical documents of all time, and admittedly, Richard, by his own admission, wasn't in the greatest of conditions for that performance. And, you know, you add up the tragic demise and The Last Waltz, and you kind of, that was it. And I once I started to dive into Richard's life, you know, there was just so much more there, obviously enough to fill a book. And I really wanted to draw attention to that before those stories disappeared. And hopefully I was successful in, like you said, balancing those two things. But there was, you know, there was some concern from fans that I've just heard from about, you know, is this going to be a very sad book? And I was like, you know, there's a lot of good and there's a lot of joy in it to offset, you know, his eventual end.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a tragedy no matter how you look at it. So it's interesting that you paint this portrait of what seems like a kind of a normal kid, right? He's got three brothers. He's got a paper route for a while. He sings in church. Even his teen hell raising kind of seems normal to me. Although as I was reading the book, and I'm wondering, as you were interviewing people in the book, you know, what sort of seems like normal teen hell raising might have been signs of deep seated trouble in people. It's funny because if the guy has a happy ending, then that chapter is, oh, he was a goofy teen and he outgrew it. But if not, then I'm looking back going, boy, was this a sign of what was something going wrong inside this guy, even at a young age?
I feel like, to your point, he was a daredevil from an early age. And I think the car, his driving in the cars were, you know, kind of encapsulate that ideal. I don't know, you know, he was a very, from all accounts, very happy kid. And all his friends had nothing but joy emanating from him. And Richard was the kind of guy that made him feel good to see other people laugh. He would put himself in the middle of things in order to get things going and have other people have a good time. Now, that could be cover for deep-seated issues, which obviously there were somewhere inside of him. But, you know, growing up, family, friends, by all accounts, he was, like you said, a normal guy doing normal things. Now, that being said, he did start the drinking at an early age. And, you know, in that time period, addiction was a funny thing, whereas it wasn't recognized as such, you know, and it didn't really rear its ugly head until much later. But, you know, early on, he was a party guy his whole life. And unfortunately, you know, those things catch up with anybody. And once you enter the world of rock and roll, as you know, talking to a number of musicians, you know, anything can happen, and they often do.
So you traced his first band, The Revels, and this is like sort of a typical type of band that was springing up all over at that time, and they end up opening up for Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks. He's like 17 when this happens. Long story short, and again, this is one of the many parts of the book that you have deeply researched. Ronnie Hawkins sets them up in his club in Arkansas, and it's a great look at sort of what that pre-Beatles club world looks like. Can you tell me what the Revels live thing was like, and what a part of it Richard was, and about his really wholeheartedly embracing that sort of on-the-road lifestyle?
Well, what really separated the Revels from other bands, as you mentioned, that were springing up was their love of R&B and the blues. As you probably know, it took a while for the United States to realize the gift they had with the blues musicians that were here. It took bands like the Yardbirds, you know, them, to really draw attention and get respect to the blues guys that were in the States. Richard and John Till and Kenny Kalmuskie and Jimmy Winkler, the guys in the Revels, they blues purist from at an early time when it wasn't the norm. And, you know, in Canada, these guys are playing the parks and at parties and clubs, and they're playing these songs that really weren't really familiar to the general population. And, you know, rock and roll right in that era when the Revels were going strong, 1960, you know, with Elvis going back into the army, rock and roll had kind of become, for lack of a better term, sanitized at that point. You know, it was kind of in a weird area. And these guys were just like gritty, gut bucket R&B blues for a bunch of young kids, you know, growing up in Canada. And when they went down to Arkansas, they fit right in. And that's part of the reason why Ronnie, you know, fell in love with Richard, seeing him famously sing Ray Charles, as well as Bobby Bland and James Brown. He was equally adept at singing all of his blues idols. And I really think that those guys grasping, the entire band grasping that genre of music and taking it to a new audience, and then taking it to the source and playing it authentically and convincingly, really just shows how important they were. And that was a part that was highly underrepresented when talking about the band and Richard, you know, specifically.
It is an interesting way to spend your adolescence, drinking, taking pills, and having sex as much as possible. I mean, and as you put it, they're playing music almost 7 days a week. And also, Richard seems like a guy who was practicing. You know, he just loved it so much and wanted to get better. He himself would just go and practice for hours and hours and hours on end. There's a quote in your book, I think it's Levon Helm in his memoir, says that Richard told him that when he was 17, that he'd been drinking for 17 years. And there's a quote from Robbie Robertson that says, "When I first met Richard, he was 17 and he was already a drunk." You know, you mentioned this earlier, that this just was kind of not, you know, it was just a different time and a different place. And that's something that sort of just kept coming back to me over and over as I read the book, was should people have helped this guy?
Yes. And, you know, it's easy to say, but what I learned is, especially later on, is in his band, everybody kind of needed help. And I don't think that it was I think hindsight is a lot of it, that, you know, and there's still guilt in the air for what happened to Richard later. But I really feel like it was like living in that moment, living in those times, it just wasn't recognized. I truly believe, you know, both Levon and Robbie's quotes, look, it's what they saw out of Richard, but I truly believe it wasn't recognized until later, you know, and it's well documented. These guys all had their issues later. I think early on, from all accounts, especially with the Hawks, I mean, these guys were girls, cars, and music. That's really, and I don't even know what order they would go in of importance. But yeah, for Richard, that's what it was at that point. Girls, cars, and music, you know, and they switched, I guess, to be the lead spot. There was a lot of that going on. And, you know, especially the kids that wanted to go to rock shows, that was part of it, is getting out of there, out of their parents' house, going out, seeing this music, getting crazy, drinking beer without anybody knowing. And I just think, you know, looking back at it, Richard just took it to a new level, which he did for everything, music most importantly.
You do a great job talking about Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks and what a phenomenon that band was and how young they were and how great they were. One of the things that's interesting is that Ronnie Hawkins' sound sort of, you know, in the course of music history and in the course of Richard's story, is that his sound sort of starts becoming old-fashioned, and the book sort of traces how the guys who became the band and their generation, they were the ones to lead how music evolved, that combination of influences that they had. But it's also important to remember, and I really got this in the book, was it really crystallized just how their time with Ronnie Hawkins helped form them and stayed with those guys forever.
Exactly. And that you hit it right on the head with that, because, and Richard's been quoted by saying, you know, it was like boot camp. And he says it in an affectionate way, because one thing I found over that time, over Richard's career, is, you know, he worked best in collaborative groups and with some sort of construct, some sort of form, you know? And I believe that having form and having someone that would make them practice, make them work, and give them a work ethic really, really did a lot for all of them. And I kind of tried to trace the arc of Richard's playing, you know, because of every night, six nights a week, you know, multiple sets. And to your point, eventually they outgrew it and they basically learned to walk, you know, it's like they grew up, they learned to walk, and they could do it on their own. And it's funny, you know, they said, we're never going to back somebody, or, you know, in Robbie's book, he's like, we were never going to back anybody after we got out on our own. But obviously that changed with a certain folk singer that popped onto the scene, but they ended up backing somebody again, but it all worked out and helped them cultivate their craft, you know?
Yeah. That's interesting. One of the strange things about him, and I'd always heard this, is that Grand Marnier became Richard's sort of essential beverage of choice. Such a weird choice. I mean, it's just like a little bit of that stuff goes a long way, but I mean, he's a guy who drank a lot of it. Do you have any idea where that came from?
Well, from what I've heard and what I found out was Bo Diddley, one of Richard's idols, one of the guys he would, you know, spin 7 inches and listen to WLAC coming out of the States and focus on these songs. In Bo Diddley's Guide to Survival, and you can find this clip, I quote some of it in the book, he makes the comment that Grand Marnier helps the singer keep his throat in working order in smoky clubs. And it's funny because I can just visualize it, you know, Richard leaning over to somebody and being like, you know why I'm drinking this Grand Marnier? It's because Bo Diddley says, you know, and I truly feel like, I mean, that's what really got him to note it. But to your point, you know, it was it's a sticky sweet and little too much, but he certainly enjoyed it. I mean, amongst other things, but I really feel like everything that happened with Richard, I always can trace back to his love of R&B and the blues and that stuff that really got him, you know, in Stratford, listening to the radio and getting those records. Even his songwriting was all rooted in the blues, but Bo Diddley, yes, that's where I think he got it from.
Yeah, that Bo Diddley document is pretty funny. It's easy to find online. So around 1964, they leave Ronnie Hawkins and start doing their own thing. They play 2 weeks at the Peppermint Lounge from 9 p.m. to 3 a.m. And then I have to sort of stop and ask you about a place called Tony Mart's. It is this place in Summers Point on the Jersey Shore, and it's a massive place. You describe 7 bars, 20 cash registers, 40 bartenders and bouncers, and they played there for almost a whole summer. What, I mean, that scene, I never heard of that place. That scene sounds like it was wild.
Oh, absolutely. From all accounts that I've heard, it was absolutely crazy. Again, the Hawks going in there. And at this point, you know, like you said, leaving Ronnie, they had started to create their own set, play the stuff they love, their stories. I think I mentioned a book of Garth jumping on the bar. I mean, Garth Hudson, can you imagine this? Jumping on the bar and blowing sax and, you know, the cops coming in and asking the Hawks to just quiet down and stop because they would just blast until they couldn't anymore. And a really cool story I was told by the son of the owner of Tony Mart's was that there were people coming up, you know, the hipsters from Atlantic City and the guys down there, they would hear about Rich, this skinny kid with the big nose who was singing James Brown and Ray Charles. And he said people were coming up to the club because they had heard about Richard in this voice. But they really, I feel like, you know, as you mentioned with what happened with the Hawk, I feel like the same thing at Tony Mart's, it melded them, this practice and this, you know, everything that they formulated later as the band, the eye contact, the subtle signals, the, you know, the turn on a dime stuff, that was all created on that on those Tony Mart stages. I write about it because it's just so, it hit me when I was interviewing people about this, the film, Eddie and the Cruisers, that was filmed at Tony Mart's. The actual Tony Mart's. I feel like you can kind of get that vibe from some of those fictional scenes of, you know, the wild, crazy summer nights and the small stage. And I wish there were recordings. Stuff always pops up and I just keep my fingers crossed that a night at Tony Mart's will pop up on a recording. And, but yeah, that's really where they became something greater than the Hawks, I feel like.
That's one of the things you do in the book is you do chronicle their recordings and some of their unofficial recordings and live recordings, audience recordings, all. And that sort of helps you sort of map their evolution. Yeah, I would say if I could have a time machine and only go to one of their gigs over their whole career, it would be one of those Tony Mart's gigs for sure. So the story is that eventually Bob Dylan calls the payphone at Tony Mart's and says, hey, I'm looking for a band. And it takes a while, but eventually all of the Hawks are drawn into Dylan's band. It's interesting because you describe how Dylan, you know, didn't like rehearsal, love spontaneity, whereas the Hawks didn't quite work that way. So what did Richard think going into the Dylan camp? What was his feelings about it?
Richard was always up for anything, really. He was, you know, we all have the type of friend that's ready to do whatever circumstances require. There was frustration, and I document a little bit on some studio recordings after they'd been with Dylan for a while. And when they first got together, Dylan, you know, he had learned about the Hawks from Mary Martin, who worked for Albert Grossman, and she kept on Dylan about, you got to hear these guys. And Dylan had reached out, as you just stated, to Levon and Robbie, because that's what he needed, was a drummer and a guitarist. And after Levon and Robbie played 2 shows, one at the Hollywood Bowl and the one Forest Hills, and Levon and Robbie both say this in their memoirs, they're like, you know, you take all of us or you don't take any of us. So Dylan traveled up to Toronto and rehearsed with these guys. And by all accounts, it was difficult to get it together. Dylan was not an electric guitar player. Trying to keep things in the pocket, which is where the Hawks were at that point. And, you know, Dylan was coming in with all originals. And they weren't, you know, this wasn't the Hawks set. This was learning new music. Again, to your point, you can kind of trace this evolution on these ramshackle early performances. And it's really undescribable music because it sounds like Bob Dylan, but it sounds like something that's never been done before, you know, even looking back at it. Eventually, over time, they tighten that stuff down. I mean, there's actually reports that Robbie would unplug Dylan's guitar on stage because he was used to being a solo performer, so it was hard to stay in meter and it would throw everybody off.
you kind of think of the band and Dylan as this kind of magical combination, but it makes perfect sense that it wouldn't work right away, and that playing electric guitar is very different from playing acoustic guitar, and that, you know, why would a band who've been playing, you know, Bo Diddley covers for 6 hours a night be good at backing Bob Dylan? You know, it makes sense, but that was a real lesson I learned in the book. So as the fame of the band grew, it seems like Richard got more self-medicated, more uncomfortable. And there's like a weird sort of, you describe this kind of self-loathing human being, this self-pity he had. Is there any idea where it came from? I mean, I know we sort of already touched on this, but at this point, it's just getting so strange. Is it just like mental illness he was born with, you think?
See, and that's the thing. It's hard for me to analyze from you know, almost like a psychiatrist point of view, you know. But looking at it from the music and looking at it from the fame, first off, Richard could not say no, and that's a beautiful thing, and it's a horrible thing. There's no doubt that Richard had some emotional issues. It's hard for me even, and this was something I talked with my editor about, even after writing a full book about him and learning as much and capturing his essence as much as I could, you really don't know. He was human, you know, and those things that, it's hard to grasp what's going on internally, you know, because by all accounts, he was a happy, loving dude. Pulling from the musical aspect, I feel like at some point, Richard gave up as far as it's all self-confidence. And Michael, that's where I kind of land on this whole thing, is the self-confidence issues leads to self-medicating, and then you're in this vicious cycle. And then, like I said, you're in the grips of something that you can't control. And I really feel like, and you alluded to it when we first started speaking about this roller coaster of highs and lows through the book, and that's really what it is. You know what I mean? It's getting a grip. It's getting control of where he was, who he was. But really, and like Van Morrison says, you know, fame is not good for the creative process. And I feel like that's why some of his creativity took a hit, and also why some of his confidence took a hit. It really wasn't something that I think people were aware of or looking for, because the guy was so joyous and creative.
It's weird, and that's a very interesting perspective. So after the band starts recording as the band, I would say it seems to be around the second album, there's just kind of a long, slow decline until the Last Waltz. It seems like he just wasn't really prepared for the fame or the money, or sort of coming out of that cocoon of being one of five guys. You know, it's interesting, you know, backing someone is kind of like a safe spot. And so the book details so many stories that sort of illustrate all this stuff. So the Last Waltz concert, you say that the film minimized his contributions to the band's legacy overall. We sort of already talked about this a little bit. There's this kind of narrative out there, and I guess some band fans are in different camps about this, and I guess Levon Helm's book sort of kind of puts the spotlight on Robbie kind of trying to rewrite history a little bit. Where do you stand on that?
Well, the one thing that I think is very important, the thing that separates Richard from that, is that Richard wrote songs. Levon wasn't a songwriter, and I apply that in the book. He was a master arranger. He had the greatest feel, wonderful drummer, better singer. All his contributions were just vitally important. But Richard wrote songs from the time he was 17 years old. And there was this thing that's been kind of floating around that, like, Richard stopped writing songs. We couldn't get Richard to write songs, you know, from the Robbie side of the camp. So when it comes to like the songwriting stuff, I truly feel like there were songs where maybe the credits obviously were not appropriated in the right way. But I think, and this goes back to the self-confidence thing, I feel like that Richard, as a songwriter, got to the point where a lot of his songs were left on the cutting room floor. And I feel like it just, again, hit his confidence. And then you exasperate that with drugs and alcohol, and you've got a mixture for disaster. And then you add fame, like we talked about. And all these things just wore him down.
It's interesting because it's all tied in perhaps with his own sort of insecurity and self-loathing, etc. You know, maybe had he had the ability to advocate for himself better, it all would have been better. You say that he did very few interviews in his lifetime. Do you know why that is?
Well, like early on, I found a couple, like when they toured Europe in 1971, Richard did a couple pretty insightful interviews. He did the major one, which obviously I tapped, was the one he did in the Woodstock Times in 1984, which he really was very candid about his drinking and very open about, you know, how he felt about things musically and where the band was. But I feel like Richard, again, that self-deprecating view, that kind of like, I'm just a guy, not a leader, not the figurehead of the group. He never moved into that spot. He was never comfortable in that spot. Again, I just think it's that balance of self-confidence, as you said, self-loathing, and then brought on by different chemicals. It was like the worst kind of thing, you know, to bring him down. Now, that being said, and you can trace this in the book, he brought himself out of it a number of times. I think it got to a point where it was too much. And, you know, when he did stop drinking, it almost killed him. So it's such a contrast, you know?
It's weird because he does stop and start, but it seems to me part of the problem is that he never kind of developed a post-band identity. You know, he never figured out who he was without the other guys around him. Do you think he could have, he never put out a solo record, for instance, in his lifetime. Do you think he could have been a viable solo artist? Because I'm not sure I mean, he had some songs, but I'm not sure I see this guy leading a band and being in a van and dealing with record companies. You know, do you think it could have happened?
I think the one thing, and this is, you know, me hoping more than anything, I feel like he was going to do stuff, work on some music with Eric Clapton. They had some tentative plans to do things in 1986. I also feel like if Richard would have held on in this, the tragedy would not have happened. You know, Rick and Richard did these small duo shows, Levon and Rick, different combinations, and I feel like, you know, it was a low point for legacy artists from the 60s and 70s. You know, the early 80s were really a low point. And a lot of them were fighting through addictions. A lot of musicians were considered passe at that point. And I feel like if Richard could have held on, the Unplugged, and then leading up to the stuff at the barn, that's exactly where he thrived, is collaborative, as you kind of alluded to, collaborative with friends, creating music, no preconceived ideas, just jamming and creating for the joy of being with other people and making music, which is really what it's all about anyways. And to your point, it almost like he lost a family when the band, you know, and he even said the band didn't break up. You know, I thought we were just on a hiatus. And he said in another in a later interview, you know, I just sat around for 5 or 6 years waiting for the call. And I think that Richard held out hope until the very end that something would happen, whether it was with all of the band, or him and Robbie could get together and write songs, or he could find a collaborator. And Eric was going to move into that spot as well. You know, it was easy for them to make music together. They just needed to get it together. And I totally could see something like an album of Ray Charles covers, just some sort of collaborative with someone that could really match his melodicism with some lyrics and some attentiveness. I think that's what really Richard needed.
So March 86, he's 42 years old. He kills himself in a hotel bathroom in Florida. It really seems like nobody saw this coming at all. There was no, you know, not like he had been tried it before or was, you know, particularly lower than usual, which just made it strange, even more strange, I think.
He was hitting his stride because he had played in November. You know, he had played in late 85 back in Stratford. The band played there. The Revels reunited. They did a show at the Festival Theater in Stratford, Ontario. And Richard went home and was just, he was just so happy to return home as the triumphant guy, you know, coming back and playing songs for his people and seeing his friends and reuniting. And then he did he'd done one in October, but he did a show at the Getaway, a solo show in December. in Woodstock. And, you know, I'm of the opinion one of the most intimate and important things a musician can do is share new music with an audience. And Richard did that at these shows. You know, he premiered three originals that, and typical, Richard says on the tape, he goes, you know, this song needs words, send them to the bartender. And, you know, I mean, he was screaming out for a collaborator. He was screaming out for someone to initiate his next move. And when it comes down to it, it was all on Richard to be responsible for that, you know? But he had songs, at least four fully formed instrumentals that needed words. He had a song called Breaking New Ground that he had been working on since 1980. And he ended up collaborating with Jerry Goffin, who helped with the words. And it's all there. You can hear the trademark Richard rolls. You can hear the melody lines. You know, they're all there. They're recognizable. And he was on his way. And to your point, 3 months later, 4 months later, it's gone. And the only thing I can attribute to that is the death of Albert Grossman, Richard drinking on the road, you know, small clubs, people buying drinks for the piano player. It's hard to say no when you've got a problem. And there was a lot going on, management issues, band's manager, crappy equipment. And I just feel like, you know, once he took another drink, he couldn't go through what he went through and when he went cold turkey and almost died. So I feel like he was in a catch-22 at that point, musically, with his family, guilt, with the drinking. I think it just overtook him, and we can't even contemplate why or how or what he felt, but it's like the veil came down all at once, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a tragedy. Well, once again, the book is called Richard Manuel, His Life and Music from the Hawks and Bob Dylan to the Band. It comes out June 17th. Stephen Lewis, thank you so much. I want to point out, too, that we are just scratching the surface. It's a 400-page deep dive into his life, his work, his recordings, his live itinerary. It's all in this book, lovingly. Clearly, this is a labor of love for you, clearly.
I appreciate, you know, that you can discern the love in it, because really I'm really proud that Richard's family can look at this and he can finally have a tribute.
Yeah, yeah. Folks can go to talkfromtherockroom.com for information about Stephen and all of your work. Once again, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I used to smoke. I used to drink. I used to smoke, drink, and dance the hoochie coo.